As I said last night, I really enjoy coming to the Seattle Insight community. This Insight community has been a thriving community, and so it's great to get the chance to support it and get to exposed to your practices. And likewise, from my point of view, of welcome those of you who have come here as my students from some other locale or other experience, and then those of you who got here by however it is that you found out about this. So very happy to be here with you. And our theme this weekend is around humility, dignity, and integrity is tied into a much larger approach to practice. And this approach to practice involves getting out of our own way, that we are finding a way to have the ego not making all the decisions, which tends to be the ego when it's, because I call it the executive functioning, it's actually a cluster of capacities that our mind has that allows us to recognize ourselves as a separate person and to make our way in the world, and lots of useful things and necessary things about our ego organization. So we're not trying to we're not following that path of no ego, no problem. That's not the approach this particular approach to practice takes. It acknowledges the ego and its role in our functioning, our surviving, and our thriving. We need an ego. And I said last night, the ego is really useful. Don't leave home without it. It's very hard to make decisions without the ego at times. So, but we're learning to let the ego move into a more natural place in the larger psychic experience, in this relationship to awareness, this knowing capacity. The ego is one kind of way that we know, that kind of evaluation, but there's other ways we know, and the Dharma is one of the ways we know that we perceive a situation and we know what's the appropriate response to the situation. And the Dharma is far less self-referenced, but it is as benevolent as one could hope for. And we learn to differentiate and move to a more and more non-attached way of meeting life, but never abandoning our own physical health, our own well-being in terms of mental health, our own sense of what makes a life for us. So it's the Dhamma, in my experience of it, is not a negation. It's not a negation, but rather a larger perspective, a deeper perspective, a perspective that gives more choice in how we relate, how we relate, how we relate. Take a moment with that. Have you formed a view around the Dhamma? In your view around the Dhamma, is there a lot of judging? Do you judge your practice quite frequently? Seems to me there's a lot of that that happens as I listen. These practice groups, people come in to talk about their practice, a lot of judging. And likewise, a lot of comparing. And people talk about their comparing more casually than they do. When they come in, they report what they don't like about their practice or how it's not going well. But it's more the casual conversation that I get to hear about the comparing mind. And then repeatedly, I hear reports that are based on a fixing attitude, a fixing. But the Dhamma and our practice doesn't quite work that way. It's not like the washing machine needs fixing. It's not like I got to remember to always lock my door because it will not self-lock. I have to lock it. It's not like that. It's a different kind of release with this release from what? Release from our habitual entanglements, the Buddha would say, our habitual entanglements. So we employ this process in this natural arising approach to practice of getting centered in ourselves with a directional, that we become that our direction of practice, the way our attention is turning towards the moment in practice. And it's very deliberate. It's very deliberate. We're turning towards practicing in a way that judging and comparing and fixing mind are mentalized. We're not expecting we're going to perfectly get rid of them, but we create more and more moments. And over the years, you get more and more in your daily life, and not just on practice, moving away from the habits of judging and comparing and fixing. And in this process, there's these three attitudes, capacities, different ways you can describe them, of of humility, recognizing humility, finding it in ourselves, realizing that, oh, it's such an advantage to have humility, and that humility is already there in us. It's already there in us. It's the way we have met life to this point, where in a compensatory way, we've gotten all puffed up, and in terms of thinking we're special, and we get challenged if we're not able to live that, and somehow if it's not being mirrored back to us, or we come in with this feeling of inadequacy. And that feeling of inadequacy is coming from this judging mind just as much as when we think, well, I'm a performer and I'm supposed to win in practice. A sit's supposed to be a good sit, and I'm in a battle to have a good sit. I don't know, how's that gone thus far in your practice? And so we are finding, we one of the things we will do is take renunciation around this judging mind, and likewise around the comparing mind, that we will deliberately commit as best we're able to letting loose a comparing mind when it arises. And then the same with fixing mind. It, judging, comparing, and fixing, if you watch it just even casually, you can see the selfing that occurs. We create a self that is somehow inadequate. And so we are resulting, we're judging our practice from practicing results, practicing results. And the invitation is to let loose of practicing results and to practice practice. You practice practice. You are here to practice. The results are going to come as they're going to come. So many aspects of what we want to happen are beyond our conscious control. So we have very modest, a sense of being able to do results. But we do have significant capacity to affect our practice. So we're practicing practice. Does this make sense? We'll have a question period about this later, but you can ask more about it. So we're practicing practice. Practicing practice requires a kind of shift in view, a shift in view. The a key element in shift in view is coming from an attitude as best I am able. So many people literally in the hundreds, have been affected by this teaching and starting to employ it in their own practice. So we are deliberately shifting from this resulting to practicing practice as best I am able. And what would get in the way of as best I am able? What would make that hard? A mind that has to that is not comfortable in itself, so it gets humiliated by defeat, or it needs to see that, oh, how great I'm doing. And so this the need for having recognizing the naturally arising humility when we're with the Dhamma. It's too large to think it's we can own it, that we can be in a controlling of the Dhamma, our experience in the Dhamma. And so best I am able needs the humility. Likewise, we can get frustrated, we can be disappointed that the sit's not going a certain way. We can't get our mind to be still. We're caught in some sort of memory loop where we're thinking about something that we said to our significant other at breakfast, and the whole sit's going around and around about that. Not helpful. And we can get this feeling, we start judging ourselves, comparing ourselves in such a way that we're not available for practice anymore. We're all caught up in our own experience, or we get uncomfortable and therefore we use escapes. So we start fantasy, or we start planning, and but we're getting somewhat concentrated, so that planning is really kind of juicy, or that fantasy, wow, much better than watching a movie. Whew. And that's because we are getting concentrated. And that makes that's one of the contradictory things about meditation practice, is that as we gain more samadhi, the mind becoming more concentrated, collected and unified, I call it, then we our mind can make distractions far more rich than we usually have in life. And all sorts of things happen in this way. And somewhat longer retreats, we have these occurrences called Vipassana romances, where somebody in the room has caught someone's attention and they have this whole imagined relationship with them, and that can go all the way through various times in this relationship life. And it's so delicious to people, it's hard for them to let loose of it because of this concentrated mind in this way, because the concentrated mind has not come into just being concentrated. It's kind of come in a way that's through the efforting, and the efforting, it's getting rewarded. And we so in this natural arising, we come to the collecting and unifying the mind, to coming into more concentration, more samadhi, without ever trying to get there. We're not trying to do that. We're practicing practice in a way that leads us to this, but we're not striving. There's not a goal like that. The goal is that we show up to practice. That's the goal. That's the goal. I wish to practice as best I am able, taking the directions that is being offered, or if there's some way that I practice that I want to just stay with the way I practice, then, but to do it with this attitude that's being offered by the teaching. So that's the second reason for these three, for the necessity of dignity. When we have an inner dignity, when we respect ourselves because we're practicing practice, we are practicing practice, and we know we are practicing practice. We know that. It's verifiable. And we discover that best I am able brings this innate dignity to us. What is that dignity? I would say that it is in the heart, that it's in your heart, that it is in the impersonal heart nature of the human mind, the human mind, heart, the human experience, the way this our access to this extraordinary reflective awareness, where we can be aware of ourselves and know that we're aware of ourselves and know that there's a capacity of consciousness that knows knowing. And that in that, the very, what allows all of that to happen, what would be called this, in Tibetan, this radiating quality, this empty radiating quality that's responsive in Tibetan practice, that it's there in the Theravadan practice as well, just named differently. And that is what, that it is that very essence. It's impersonal essence, this dignity. It's impersonal, but each of us experience it in a personal way. You get that? When we're raising children, what parent would not want the child to experience this innate dignity? This innate dignity that's tied into love, the capacity to love and to receive love. Who would not want that for a child? So who would not want that for yourself? Who would not want that for the members of your Sangha? Who would not want that? So we have this term you'll hear me use over and over again, of directionally aligned. The way we're practicing is directionally aligned with wholesomeness, in the wholesomeness of the Eightfold Path. So we are cultivating intention. That's part of wise view in the Eightfold Path. And we're cultivating intention. Sorry, I said that wrong. We're cultivating intention, which is part of the wisdom, part of the Eightfold Path. And we're also cultivating mindfulness, which is part of the Eightfold Path. And mindfulness needs intention, and intention needs mindfulness. They come together, and they use Manisam Sayadaw this wise attention. They together can create wise attention. And wise attention and this surrender way of practicing wise attention is that you are practicing practice. And there is a freedom in letting go of that striving. Letting go. And so the humility, I'm practicing practice as best I am able, leads actually to, I'm a practitioner, and a different feeling of it. Because it doesn't have all of the baggage that we have all acquired. We have the variations of the baggage, but this baggage of selfing, this selfing. And we get so enamored of how am I doing and all. Oh, I'm doing practicing practice. And then the integrity is to not use as best I am able as a bypass, as a spiritual bypass. Because we can do that, you know. We can excuse ourselves. We can sit there and not have a feeling of integrity in our practice and excuse it. The integrity doesn't get measured by how well the practice is going. The results are based on so many different conditions. The things in the room that are not you, you know, how your stomach is this particular day, how you slept, your entire history, the history of the teacher. It's on and on and on, the karmic conditions. So that's why we don't trust how well am I doing. We do look at, we're aware of, oh, when I do this, that's not skillful. That's learning about our practice. Do you see? We say, oh, I have a habit of when I get to a certain degree of stillness, I really have this proclivity that has just developed in me to actually go to imagination. I start dreaming something. I'm making my own movie. And I do this. This is not just a one-time thing. This is one of my habits of mind. And so as we're practicing practice, we discover ways that we're skillful and not skillful in practicing practice as integrity in itself of practicing practice. So that's the big picture of the day in that way. And when we start to see that with this sort of an attitude, things that we have aspired to in our practice naturally arise, and we just discover, well, my mind is pretty concentrated. When did that happen? When did that happen? Or, oh, I have this ease happening around this difficult situation in my life, but I never actually examined that. How come there's this ease? Because you naturally have the capacity to be at ease with the difficult. It's natural. It's already there. We each do. And what we're gradually doing is the entanglements that catch us, as the Buddha kept pointing out, and I'm pointing out, and honor the Buddha's footsteps, which we all step in, the footprints of the elephant. We're being available to know this. We use these terms, these practice momentum building, structuring of practice around a three-part sequence called the arriving sequence, in which we first bring our mindfulness to front and center, and that's arriving. We're arriving in this moment here and now. It's a deliberate practice, but we're just arriving, and we're practicing arriving. Sometimes we really get there, and sometimes we don't. We are just making ourselves lined up in that way. This is directionally aligned, and then we experience being available because we are mindfully present. We're available to being in a mindful, wise relationship, a kind relationship with what occurs in our minds and what's in our hearts. We're available. We have choice. We have choice in how we relate to these various experiences we have, thoughts we have, judging, comparings that we have. We have a way to relate to them because we are present in a mindful way, and we are choosing. We're choosing. We have choice to how we respond when something difficult comes up in our mind. We have choice. Choice. And then the third part of the arriving sequence is the recognition of the need for aligning. And this is as old as humankind and all the religions. There is a need to align with something larger than the ego, or the ego is otherwise given way too much of a burden. Way too much of a burden. It's got so many other tasks that it's got to do that this idea that we can stay in an available in a way that is responsive rather than reactive, all on our own, too much, too much. And so we align, and that's why we're drawn to whatever spiritual practice we're drawn to. You're here, so assuming that you're drawn to the Buddhist practice of relating, one can argue in various ways about is the Buddhism a religion, since it lacks ontological story, but it for sure is a spiritual practice, and it is a spiritual practice that brings well-being and highly ethical behavior and much generosity. So whatever your view of that, we don't really need to get into that. I don't get involved in those kind of religious arguments one way or the other. But we know that we are aligning with something larger. And I will give you in these meditations a series of things that you may be aligned with. What does aligned mean? It means that we are bringing into the mind our relatedness to the Buddha or to the Dhamma or to the Sangha or to metta, this loving kindness practice, or to compassion practice, this karuna. We are bringing some way that we're in relationship that is inspiring to us, and this protects us from our mind as it gets concentrated, going off on its trips, going off its trips. And it's not we're going to punish ourselves or we're going to smash it if the mind starts going off. No, we're going to love it up. We're going to just love up these tendencies of mind. And the more difficult, the more ornery they are, just like, the 2.5, 3-year-old that won't put on her shoes. You don't hate that 2.5, 3 years old, but you do have to deal with her. She's there. And so it is in our own minds, So it is in our own minds. So we're opening to this. We're opening to this in this way. And the aligning has an uplifting quality and a protection quality. So we're inspired. It brings us, if we're going to talk technical Buddhism, it brings us to wise view. It brings us to wise view, that aligning. We're seeing both the relative of wise view that yes, that with this practicing as best I am able, we're more able to choose non-suffering over suffering. We have more clarity of seeing what is and more capacity for wise response. And we also, that's the relative, and then the absolute of liberation. Oh, liberation that literally, as the Buddha did, step away from the whole entanglement as a concept, as a container of reality, where there's a shift in view, where it's a different reality. And in the Theravadin, that's taught as happening in stages. There's these different stages, stream enterer, or once returner, or so forth, non-returner, arahat. There's stages of all of that. We're not, in this practice, we're not interested in all of those stages and all those ideas. We're interested in here and now. So the practice is the immediacy of how we're relating to this moment in this available aligned way that gives us choice. A choice of what ultimately. So we start out with being able to move from a reactive mind, a habitual mind, a conditioned mind, to a responsive mind that has freedom in it. And ultimately, to more and more, and I mean this quite literally, to be able to recognize what is suffering and not suffering. To have the realization that, oh, I can choose non-suffering, even though right now the goodies would be going with what's going to cause me suffering, because we do give up. It is a renunciation practice. We're learning to choose what is beneficial to us in time, not just what we want in this moment, what our ego wants or what our lust wants is just our animal body. We're for food or sex or whatever, we're learning to do that, to have that kind of choice. We realize it's possible. If we don't recognize what's suffering and non-suffering, then the realization that we can choose non-suffering just doesn't have a place because we miss the whole experience over and over and over and over again to choose non-suffering. But in time, with practice, we more and more become available in this way. And it all happens naturally. This whole, I've, I decided to lay out this map this morning, just based on some comments last night that we were having afterwards. Susan and I had this little short conversation, but it changed the way I wanted to start this day, because I wanted to start with a large view. This is a whole entire practice method. You are learning to cultivate the skill of recognition. The skill of recognition. And you don't have to remember all of this. It just happens as you practice this practice. It will naturally arise, this skill of recognition. The Buddha over and over again is asking all the various people he's teaching to. He's giving them ways to recognize. Even that thing when the eye is burning, the ear is burning, and like to recognize that that's true. And then, well, with what is it burning? Oh, it's burning with greed. It's burning with this. Those are all recognitions. They are not intellectual concepts. We teach them sometimes as descriptive descriptions that are in that 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 the. That the freedom is going to come if we get all the understandings, if we have all the intellectual view or just right, then somehow we're going to be freed by our intellectual view. Those of us who've been practicing 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 years, is that really how it works? Is that really how it works in the moment in your life? When the hindrances are there. Not so often, maybe, not so often. So we're being able to recognize and respond. We recognize and we can respond. And in this sequence of that we recognize, we realize, and then we have the resolve to let loose. We let loose. We're entangled, and now we're not. Where we are, it's called enchantment. We're enchanted in the dependent origin arising. Dependent arising is how we get into suffering. We get seduced. We get enchanted, and this word of being disenchanted is used in the text. We become disenchanted. That's not means that we become disillusioned. That we become, that's getting lost in a different way, bitter, down on oneself. There's no love in that. But we're not caught just because something's pleasant. We move away from pleasant and unpleasant being that second of the four foundations of mindfulness, the Vedana. We move away from that as what controls us. We just aren't controlled. We still like what's pleasant. Why would we not? But we are not bound by that. We're not seduced. We're not enchanted by it. Not imagining, oh, if I just had this, whether if it's if I just had a tea and a cookie instead of doing the walking practice, oh, I'll be so happy. To the way we're living our entire lives. The way we're relating to our loved ones and to the world. And it all happens naturally. Naturally. The Buddha's Dhamma is just, he points to a reality that is there, that it unfolds when we find a way to practice. There's many great ways to practice. This is just a way to practice that for a number of people that are exposed to it, it's really filled the gaps for them. It's overcome habitual difficulties. Maybe it will do that for you, and maybe it will not. But under any practice situation you're in, you discovering your natural humility is only going to benefit. There's no judging in natural humility. You cannot be humiliated. You can't be ashamed of your practice because that part of you is relaxed. It's not active. It's turned off. And so we can be impatient with ourselves, but the impatience is supported by kindness. And likewise, with this dignity, we can be sort of defensive about our practice, or defensive about you, other people have reported this or that, and you haven't had that experience. But that's not the way. You're not using comparing mind anymore. You're not trying to fix it to the way you imagine your liberation would be. You are available. And so you have this dignity that allows you to trust, because you can feel your own innate dignity. Again, I'm being quite literal here, quite literal. This is not an idea about dignity. No, I was just with my teacher, the Venerable Sumedho, at Amaravati in England just a few weeks ago. We were just reflecting this to each other. Not a concept. Not a concept. My teachings of the Four Noble Truths came directly from him, directly. So we've had this very wonderful relationship for a long time. And so when I'm saying this, these things about the dignity and so forth, it is straight Dhamma, straight Dhamma. But I'm bringing out your relatedness to it, your relatedness, that you have, I don't know, more capacity than you would imagine to affect how you relate to your practice and how you relate to your life. Much more capacity than you may realize, because you're measuring by your resulting. So you're not really available to let the capacity just be in its own.